So it's a pleasure for me to present Dr. David Berger.
Yeah, so let's see if this is set up right. Can you hear me? Hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Maybe not so good. A relative of mine who speaks publicly periodically claims that he once asked if people here could hear him in the back, and someone in the back said no, at which point someone in the front got up and turned around and said, "Can I change places with you?" we'll see. So first of all, I need to give a kind of heads up that I'm going to be speaking primarily about Jewish-Catholic relations. This is in part because Protestantism is so diffuse that it's much more difficult to give a coherent presentation on Jewish Protestant relations over these years, although I will say something near the end about the Protestant spectrum. So, let me begin by saying something which I think is necessary about the standard Christian views of Judaism through the centuries, so that we can put the Second Vatican Council and what came later into some sort of perspective. Most of you will know this essential background. The standard Christian view of Judaism and the Jews is that Jews were rejected by God and displaced by Christianity. The fancy word for this is supersessionism, that Christianity superseded Judaism. In somewhat more normal language, we now hear the term replacement theology. Now, this is connected with a very early Christian doctrine that they are the true Israel. There are two Israels. There's an Israel of the spirit and an Israel of the flesh, or carnal Israel. The Israel of the flesh is the Jews, and the Israel of the spirit is the Christians. And this was kind of demonstrated in their eyes by a genuine theme in Bereishis, namely the theme of older and younger brothers, where the younger brother is consistently preferred to the older one. And the argument was that this represents the church and the synagogue. So the older brother is the synagogue, which has been replaced by the church. And there are some quintessential passages, especially one that is critical to this, and that is the message that Rivka received from God after her difficult pregnancy, or during her difficult pregnancy. God, you will recall, tells her that there are two nations in her womb, and Rav Yavod Sa'ir, the older one, will serve the younger, and as a result, Yaakov becomes the church, and Esav becomes the synagogue, which is the reversal, of course, of the Jewish typology. They didn't know the real interpretation of Rivka's difficulty and what God told her. For that, they would have had to know a book of Jewish humor that appeared in the first half of the 20th century at a time when Jewish humor was still Jewish. It was called Sefer HaBdicha V'Hachidud, and it tells the following. How do we know, and you know, I hope people won't be offended by this, I'm almost half Litvak, but the question is, why is it better to be a goy, a word I don't usually use? I actually avoid using it, but in some context it's unavoidable, and in this joke it's unavoidable. How do we know that it's better to be a goy than a Litvak? And the answer is that Rivka, as we know from Chazal and Rashi, during her pregnancy, felt that when she passed the Beis Avodah Zorah, one of them tried to get out, And when she passed the Beis Medrash, the other one tried to get out. And she was upset. So what was she assuming at the time? Presumably she thought one of them was a goy, the one who wants to go to the Beis Avodah Zarah, and the other was a Litva, because they were always running to the Beis Medrash. And she goes to God, and what does God say to her? Shnei goyim bevitnech. They're both goyim. And she's happy. So you see that she was upset about the Litva. But the Christians and the Jews of antiquity did not know that. And they had these polar opposite understandings of who the younger brother is and who the older brother is and what they represent. For Jews, Esav actually represented, as you well know, Rome and then Christianity for reasons that are not so clear, but that's not for now. The most interesting, striking example of the brothers that, as was used by Christians, is Menashe and Ephraim, the final pair in Bereshit. And you will recall that Yosef places the older one at Yaakov's right hand and the younger one at Yaakov's left hand. But Yaakov, wanting to bless Ephraim primarily and Menashe only secondarily, makes the sign of the cross with his hands, which is a really clever einfall. Now, the Israel of the flesh, that is the Jews, nonetheless merited toleration. And this is of critical importance in Christian theology, formulated by Augustine, the greatest of the church fathers. The Jews would be given unique toleration as a non-Christian religion allowed to live in Christian lands, because of an argument that has come to be known as the witness theory. The Jews witness to the truth of Christianity. They testify to the truth of Christianity by their presence, by their existence. Why? Number one, because the Hebrew Bible is full of prophecies that demonstrate the truth of Christianity. The Jews don't see this because of blindness, but that is the case. And the Jews preserve and observe the Hebrew Bible, thus giving testimony to the validity of the message, the Christian message that is embodied in it. Secondly, the Jews testify to the truth of Christianity by their exile and suffering. The only reasonable explanation for the Jews' exile and lengthy suffering, Augustine died in 430, so we're talking about a few hundred years, but that's still much longer than the Babylonian exile was. And hence the Jews are being punished for some particularly heinous crime, worse than the idolatry and other terrible crimes of the First Temple. And that must be the crime of the crucifixion. And he even found a verse in Psalms that he said refers to the Jews and demonstrates this argument perfectly. In Psalm 59, verse 12, we find the following. Al tahagem penish kechu ami. Do not kill them, lest my people forget. Right? Don't kill the Jews, lest my people forget the truth of their of Christianity, because the witnesses will be gone. Hani emo b'chelcha, shake them up with your power. V'hori demo maginenu Hashem, and bring them down, which is the Jewish suffering part of this argument. There is even a line that I have a sneaking suspicion about. I'm not sure it's true. I'm not at all sure it's true. I once wrote it in a footnote. In one of the slichot that we say the day after Kitzon Gedalia, we find the following line. Yoshvim ke'edei shkarim b'li rosh laharim. That is, we are sitting in exile like false witnesses who cannot raise their heads. Now, the plain meaning of the people assume is that false witnesses who've been found out are embarrassed and can't raise their heads. But I wonder whether the author of this Slicha, who lived in Christian Europe in the Middle Ages, and would have been aware of this our Christian reason for tolerating Jews, is saying that one of the tragedies of exile in Christian lands is that we sit here as false witnesses. That is, we are testifying to the truth of a false religion. In any event, for most Christians, this punishment resulted not merely from the rejection of Jesus, but from Jewish responsibility for the crucifixion. With the most famous line appearing in Matthew, that the Jewish crowd says to Pontius Pilate, "His blood be on our heads and on the heads of our children." That was the status quo of Christian views of Judaism for close to 2,000 years. Until October 28, 1965, when, as part of the Ecumenical Council, the Second Vatican Council, called by the Pope, a document appeared entitled Nostra Aetate, which means in our age, section 4, which deals with the Jews. There had been a concerted effort post-Holocaust by Jewish activists, including scholars, to persuade the church that it was time to change what these Jews called the teaching of contempt. And there was some receptiveness to this message. The Holocaust certainly has something to do with it, although I think there are other things too, as I'll say in a moment. John the 23rd, who was tzaddik with respect both to the Holocaust and to the Jews, was receptive. When he died, by the way, the Hadoar, the Hebrew publication in the United States, had an editorial called Ha'apifyor Yochanan HaChaf Gimel Alav HaShalom, Pope John the 23rd, HaChaf Gimel Alav HaShalom, and someone wrote them a letter protesting, saying that he does deserve a positive editorial, but to call him a Kohen Gadol is excessive. They were kind enough not to publish this letter. Kaf Gimel is not Kohen Gadol. Now, beyond the Holocaust, however, there was the atmosphere of the 1960s. The egalitarian impulse that produced the civil rights movement in the United States and the decolonization worldwide did not sit well with traditions of religious exclusivism and triumphalism, let alone the condemnation of the other to discrimination and damnation. The key point of Nostra Aetate number 4, the Jewish section of that document, was that only the Jews directly involved in the crucifixion bear responsibility for it, not any other Jews at the time, and not any subsequent Jews. Beyond this core transformation of a traditional Christian doctrine, they asserted that Jews remain dear to God because of their fathers. God does not repent of his gifts, which is a verse in the book of Romans. The church wants to foster, they said, mutual understanding and respect through fraternal dialogue, and it decries anti-Semitism. Those are really the key elements of this document. Now, Jewish reactions were mostly very positive, though there were objections, some of which I consider petty. They decried anti-Semitism rather than condemn it. There was no reference to eliminating the accusation of deicide by name. Deicide means killing God. I have to say that I think that the Catholic explanation for not using that word is valid. They said you can't kill God. And even though the term had been used, it's not a correct theological term. Now, some Jews, but on the whole, there was very positive reaction. some Jews, especially Orthodox Jews, reacted to this as too little, too late. So contemporary Jews are not responsible for killing Jesus. Thank you very much. Now, this reaction is understandable, but it strikes me as somewhat churlish when Jews whose long-standing bill of particulars against the church featured the guilt that it assigned to the Jewish people for the crucifixion then dismiss the historic revocation of this theology as an event that should have no consequences for their own resentful stance toward the church. Orthodox Jews especially should understand how hard it is to modify accepted doctrine. On a much more profound level, there was Rav Soloveitchik's talk and later article called Confrontation, while the council was still in session. And he asserted that dialogue, interfaith dialogue regarding social issues is fine. About theology, no. He made a multidimensional argument for this position, including an overarching assertion that he surely realized was overstated, that theological beliefs are so deeply rooted in the relationship between an individual and a community with God that they cannot be communicated. Now, they certainly cannot be communicated in their fullness, but much can be communicated. The setting of the Rav's Lonely Man of Faith initially was a talk that he gave at a Christian seminary. At the same time, the Rav also made other arguments, one of which strikes me as especially telling, even prescient. Namely, the likely expectation by Christians that Jews will reciprocate their theological rethinking of their attitude toward Judaism by rethinking the Jewish attitude toward Christianity. In this context, he also expressed grave reservations about interfering in the beliefs of the other. I will return to these related concerns in due course. To implement the new relationship, the Church established a Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, which issued its first official document called Guidelines and Suggestions for Implementing the Conciliar Declaration Nostra Aetate No. 4 in 1974, 9 years after the declaration. In 1985, 11 years later, it issued, quote, notes on the correct way to present the Jews and Judaism in preaching and catechesis, which means the teaching, related to the word catechism, in the Roman Catholic Church. And in 1998, it issued a document on the Holocaust entitled We Remember. Now, despite occasional formulations that some Jews, rightly or wrongly, found inadequate or objectionable, these documents fleshed out Nostra Aetate in a direction that reflected advances achieved by ongoing dialogues and even dealt with some of the specific concerns that Jews had expressed regarding the original declaration. Thus, for whatever this is worth, the Church now condemned rather than merely decried anti-Semitism. What about the practical impact of a document like this or of documents like these? A fairly extensive survey carried out by the Anti-Defamation League in 2012 in 10 European countries, not including the former Soviet Union, asked respondents whether they thought a series of affirmations about Jews were probably true. The fifth and final of these was, the Jews are responsible, note the present tense, for the death of Jesus. The average of those responding probably true was 22%, ranging from 14% in France and Germany to 46% in Poland. The numbers would surely have been much higher two generations earlier. To a significant degree, this is because of a precipitous decline in the number of from Christians in Europe. But there is little doubt that Nostra Aetate had an effect. Needless to say, European anti-Semitism has succeeded in overcoming the obstacle of diminished belief in Jewish responsibility for the crucifixion. But that's a different subject. Not totally different, but different. In the United States, I was involved in a controversy that demonstrates the complexities in evaluating the actual impact of official church documents. I was asked by Commentary Magazine to write an article about Mel Gibson's film, The Passion. This is before it even came out. I was afraid to say yes because I can't watch horror films, and I had been told all kinds of things about how bloody and gory this is. But I agreed to do it anyway, so I was forced to see it. Fear was so ratcheted up that I was relieved when I actually saw it. In any case, in the article, I noted that William Donahue, a traditional Catholic who heads the Catholic League for Religion and Civil Rights, a kind of Catholic anti-defamation league, described The Passion in an open letter to the Jewish community as, quote, magnificent beyond words. And in an effort to allay Jewish concerns, he added that, quote, anyone who subscribes to the notion of collective guilt or who believes that today's Jews are responsible for the behavior of some Jews 2,000 years ago is demented. Now, whatever reservations one has about Donahue's characterization of the film, and I have very many indeed, his effective, if unintended, assertion was that his own immediate ancestors, as well as untold generations of Christians, were demented. Whatever his motives, this is evidence that a deep and welcome change has been effected in the psyche of mainstream American Catholics. At the same time, the Office of Film and Broadcasting of the United States Council of Catholic Bishops issued a largely positive review of Gibson's film. Several years earlier, the council had issued a document entitled Criteria for the Evaluation of Dramatizations of the Passion. Those criteria constituted a concerted effort to apply a key affirmation of Nostra Aetate by avoiding inflammatory material regarding the Jewish involvement. The positive review of Gibson's The Passion does not contain even a passing reference to the earlier official document, despite the fact that the film violates virtually every guideline that that document set forth. That review demonstrates how ineffective, in this case totally ineffective, well-meaning guidelines can be when they are thrown into the maelstrom of intense communal passion and controversy. In the last few decades, some church officials have gone beyond Nostra Aetate's statement that Jews are still dear to God who does not repent of his gifts. In a 1980 speech, John Paul II declared that the old covenant with the Jews has not been revoked, and the issue of supersessionism or replacement theology has assumed an even more central role. First of all, it has now become a more or less accepted position among Catholic authorities that non-Christians can be saved through the mysterious mediation of the Church. For some, this is especially true of Jews because of their unrevoked covenant. But they still need, the Jews still need the Church to effectuate this salvation. Now, don't ask me to explain this, because when pressed, the Catholic authorities can't explain it themselves and speak of it as a mystery. It's not even clear which covenant remains in effect. For more conservative Catholics, it is the covenant with Abraham that remains in effect. But for the more ecumenically minded, even the covenant with Moses has not been revoked. I've written a substantial article pointing to the extreme complications and ambiguities in this position. Does this mean that the Catholic position is that Jews should not wear shatnas? But these complications have not prevented some Jewish participants in dialogue from almost demanding that Christians recognize the continuing validity of the Mosaic covenant. I don't see any value in doing this, and I even consider the demand at least marginally offensive. This then brings us back to the question of intervening in the beliefs of the other. We will recall that Rabbi Soloveitchik objected to this because it is intrinsically inappropriate and because it invites an expectation of reciprocity. Thus, some Jews get upset if Christians express the expectation that Jews will recognize the truth of Christianity at the end of days. There are Jewish ecumenical types who have actually expressed vigorous opposition to Christians saying this or expressing such an expectation. But this is exactly what Jews do when they say Aleinu, or when they say on Yomim Noroim, the poem of the Soyu Kol Le'ovdecha. Some Jews who are upset by Christians doing this have started to talk about how we also shouldn't expect this. In a book by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg about Judaism and Christianity, he told a line. He claims to have come up with this himself. I think it was said earlier that when the Messiah comes, so we'll ask him, "Are you here for the first time or the second time?" Greenberg added that he would suggest to the Messiah that he refused to answer. So when I review that book in tradition, I think that this is, a dismissal of a major, major difference between Judaism and Christianity. So when I review the book, I asked whether he would suggest that the Messiah not comment when he is asked the follow-up question. Are you the incarnation of the second person of the triune God? In my view, we also have no right to tell Christians not to believe assertions in their own scriptures, including the one that Jews were the ones who persuaded Pontius Pilate to crucify Jesus. I don't think we have the right to tell Christians not to believe what it says in Matthew. However, it's not so simple. Obviously, this assertion isn't good for Jews. A very interesting document was produced at the request of a Jewish organization by two Christian theologians who happen to be Protestants about the most famous Passion Play. Passion Play is a play describing the crucifixion, which is a whole genre of drama beginning in the late Middle Ages. The most famous one now is at a place called Oberammergau, which is produced every 10 years. And the Jews wanted some changes made, and actually some changes were made. These two Protestant theologians, when they came to this line, "His blood be on our head and on the heads of our children," made a very interesting suggestion that conforms to my sense of what we can and cannot do, or what we should and should not do. The play, they said, has the crowd say this three or four times. I don't remember whether it's three or four. When Matthew has it once, and the chorus in the play responds, "His blood be on your head and on the heads of your children," affirming that this is the case. So what they said is as follows. What you should do is have the crowd say it. You don't have to cut it out. It's in Matthew. But have them say it once and not three or four times. And have the chorus reply or respond, "His blood is on your head, but not on the heads of your children." Now, that is not a change in, we're not asking for a change in Christian theology, because after Nostra Aetate number 4, that is the appropriate and official theology of the church, that the blood is not on the heads of their children. So there are ways sometimes to finesse this problem. Now, the dangers that Rabbi Soloveitchik envisioned about reciprocity and the like were brought home to me when I was quoted in a Jewish newspaper in the Jewish Week years ago that the New York Board of Rabbis should not have encouraged its members to attend an interfaith service in the main sanctuary of St. Patrick's Cathedral, because even if, as many rabbinic authorities affirm, it's a major machloket about this, that even if Christianity is not idolatry for a Gentile, it is for a Jew. A Catholic leader whom I knew became very upset and effectively said, "This is what we get after all that we have done for you in rethinking our attitudes towards Judaism." Now, I have since avoided the term idolatry, which I think probably is not a term I should have used, but I continue to use the more accurate term, Avodah Zarah. The principle of non-intervention is challenged, however, not only in the case of that Oberammergau scene, but much more deeply when it comes to missionizing. Do we have a right to try to persuade Christians not to engage in missionary activity if they consider that part of their religious obligation? Now, this is already a matter of pikuach nefesh in the spiritual sense. And if I could persuade Christians to refrain from this enterprise, I would. And I actually have attempted to do so. I was invited by the head of the National Council of Synagogues, which was the successor to the defunct Synagogue Council of America. The Synagogue Council included Orthodox representation. Its successor does not. It's an organization of conservative, reform, and reconstructionist rabbis and synagogues. The head of it, who was a conservative rabbi, very active in interfaith affairs, said that they were having a dialogue with Presbyterians, that Presbyterians were considering the question of whether they should support efforts to missionize Jews. He invited me to give a talk on the issue of conversion in Judaism and Christianity, which he said would give me an opportunity to try to formulate an argument that they shouldn't try to missionize Jews. Now, this was everything was wrong with this from one perspective. It was a theological discussion, which the Rav said you shouldn't engage in. It was a specifically non-Orthodox organization that I would be speaking for. But there was this question of whether there's some outside chance that if they're really on the fence on this issue, they could be persuaded not to do it. So for one of the very few times, less than a handful of times that I did this, I called Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in Israel. He replied with an unequivocal yes. In this case, the imperative of self-defense is so compelling that it overrides countervailing principles. Now, it's all the more evident that missionizing intent cannot be tolerated in the context of interfaith dialogue. As recently as 2009, the U.S. National Council of Catholic Bishops issued a statement containing an affirmation that shocked their Jewish dialogue partners. Quote, though Christian participation in interreligious dialogue would not normally include an explicit invitation to baptism and entrance into the church, the Christian dialogue partner is always giving witness to the following of Jesus to which all are implicitly invited. From its inception in 1998, I've participated in a dialogue between the Council of Bishops and a joint delegation of the Rabbinical Council of America and the OU. In response to this statement, I wrote to their delegation, to the Council of Bishops delegation, on behalf of our group. The letter affirmed, among other things, that, quote, this assertion that the Christian partner enters the dialogue with Jews with the intention of extending an implicit invitation to join the church strikes at the very heart of the dialogical enterprise and undermines the most basic understanding that makes that enterprise possible. In a private letter to a Jew, I propose the riddle. Provide a case where an explicit proclamation that X is X renders it something other than X. Again, provide a case where an explicit proclamation that X is X renders it something other than X. The answer is, when an implicit invitation is explicitly identified as an implicit invitation, it becomes an explicit invitation. But what is really remarkable about this story is that the Bishops' Council responded by deleting the sentence, which frankly I did not expect that it would go that far, and they did. They immediately reissued their statement without that sentence. In a few cases, I'm afraid that Jews have indeed reassessed Christianity in ways that come perilously close to reciprocity. In September 2000, a document entitled Dabru Emet was formulated by four eminent Jewish theologians and ultimately signed by well over 200 rabbis and scholars the vast majority of them not orthodox. It was organized into 8 rubrics, most of which are, in my view, unexceptionable, but there are passages that are quite objectionable, I think. One in particular, I regard the strong implication there that neither community should insist, quote, that it has interpreted scripture more accurately than the other, as uncomfortably relativistic, to put it moderately. And the assertion that Jews and Christians worship the same God is, I think, an incomplete truth. In 2015, in explicit connection with the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, several dozen relatively liberal Orthodox rabbis issued a statement on Christianity. Here again, much of it is unexceptionable, even admirable. Nevertheless, elements of this declaration are, I think, decidedly problematic. Appealing to the Rambam and Yehuda Levi, it asserts that Christianity, quote, is neither an accident nor an error, but the willed divine outcome and gift to the nations, unquote. It goes on to say that, quote, Jews and Christians have a common covenantal mission to perfect the world under the sovereignty of the Almighty so that all humanity will call on his name. Although it also asserts that the authors do not minimize the differences between the religions. Now, the authors know very well that Halevi, and even more vigorously the Rambam, saw the divine plan. They did think there was a divine plan in the establishment of Christianity, but they saw it as preparation for universal recognition of the truth of Judaism. And in the Rambam's language in that passage, at the end of days, Christians and Muslims who will have been familiarized with the Torah by their own theology will recognize that Shekel Nachalu Avoteinu Hevel Ve'en Bahem Ovil, that what we learn from our fathers is falsehood. There is something disingenuous about citing only half the position, that this is a gift to the nations with no explanation of what kind of a gift. Moreover, the affirmation that Jews and Christians have a common covenantal mission raises questions for a careful reader. It undoubtedly refers to a new theological position proposed elsewhere by Rabbi Greenberg, who was one of the document's authors, affirming the existence of a specific divine covenant with Christians of which Jewish tradition knows nothing, and that every authority through the ages to whom Orthodox Jews turn would have rejected out of hand. Finally, the assertion in that document that differences between the religions remain is a rather anemic way of recognizing that Jewish law requires martyrdom rather than conversion to Christianity. Given the critical importance of these differences to the core of the Jewish religion, this paean of praise to Christianity, much of which is deserved, needs to be leavened by a clearer affirmation of the transcendent significance of the theological chasm that remains. The declaration, despite its merits, demonstrates the prescience exhibited by the Rav in his concerns about reciprocity. Finally, I turn to Israel. Nostra Aetate decisively did away with the key theological impediments to Catholic recognition of the state. No longer could a loyal Catholic assert that Jewish dispossession from the land resulted from the sin of the crucifixion and that unrepentant Jews must remain in its exile. If Jews now are not responsible for the crucifixion, this argument doesn't work. Nevertheless, the Vatican did not establish diplomatic relations with Israel until 1993. The reasons provided for this delay were embarrassingly unpersuasive. There weren't firm borders. There wasn't a formal peace treaty. But they need not detain us here. The key point is that normal relations have been established, and they were made theologically possible by Nostra Aetate. So at long last, let me turn, however briefly, to Protestants. The Protestant spectrum is especially important in assessing attitudes toward Israel. There is definitely a moderate section of this spectrum on this issue, but for the most part, We find evangelical Christians on the religious right and usually political right who are passionate supporters of Israel. For them, the key text is God's promise to Abraham, who was also promised the land, that those who bless his descendants will be blessed, and those who curse them will be cursed. On the other end, there is also this theological story of preparation for the second coming, which I don't dismiss entirely. On the other end, liberal Protestant churches, largely represented in the World Council of Churches, usually affirm that they recognize Israel's right to exist, but at the same time engage in vigorous anti-Israel activism, including support for BDS, at least with respect to the territories, and often with respect to Israel proper. Their initiatives can also extend to active cooperation with entities that explicitly deny Israel's rights to exist. There are also serious efforts underway among certain liberal Protestant anti-Israel groups to convince young evangelicals that their religious reasons for supporting Israel are mistaken. It's noteworthy that it is the evangelicals who are most likely to question the ongoing validity of the Jewish covenant and the eligibility of individual Jews for salvation who are simultaneously supportive of Israel, which is an issue that is far more important. I would prefer that Christians consider me eligible for a portion of the world to come, since this position is likely to be associated with other positive consequences. It is, for example, less likely, if they think I do have a possibility of salvation, that they will be less interested in converting me and my fellow Jews. Still, I lose no sleep if they think I will go to hell. There are surely grounds for me to worry about my ultimate destination, but Christian theology is not one of them. At the same time, I do lose sleep, at least figuratively, over Christian opposition to Israel, and the fact that supporters of BDS believe that I will go to heaven is scant consolation. On the spectrum of Christian attitudes toward Israel, then, the Vatican stands between the almost fiercely Zionist evangelicals and the hostile Protestant groups that dominate the World Council of Churches. With all the tensions, and they are legion, it is fair to say that the Vatican, at least by the global standards that currently prevail, can be counted among the friends of the Jewish state and serves as a resource to which advocates for Israel can appeal with reasonable hope of support, at least in some cases. Let me conclude on a positive note. Last year, an alternative statement to the one by the Orthodox rabbis in 2015, and also inspired by the Jubilee of Nostra Aetate, was issued by the three major Orthodox rabbinic organizations in the contemporary world: the Rabbinical Council of America, the Conference of European Rabbis, and the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. Entitled From Jerusalem to Rome, the document affirms substantial agreement with Christians on ethical issues and points to other grounds for friendship. In the realm of theology, there is an affirmation of both significant convergence and abiding profound divergence. Its primary author was Rabbi Ari Foger of Vienna, but I played a significant role in its formulation. We went to Rome and participated in a presentation of the document to Pope Francis. The Pope noted that his advisors had told him that the agreement of three rabbinical groups on such a statement should be seen as a miracle. Now, this is certainly true, and is reminiscent of a sharp line by Rav Huttner, the famous Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. He is reputed to have commented on the famous story of the Septuagint translation, where, according to both rabbinic sources and the Church Fathers, 70 translators were placed in 70 separate rooms, and they miraculously came up with identical translations. Rav Huttner is reported to have said, "Das ist kein Nesnicht. This is not a miracle. Ob sie wollten gewen in ein Zimmer. If they had been in one room." Well, we were, by email, figuratively in one room, and still agreed on this, so it is without question a miracle, even according to Rav Huttner. So I've tried to convey some measure of the intriguing complexities that characterize the contemporary Jewish-Christian and Jewish-Catholic relationship. Nevertheless, the challenging realities that we face should not obscure the overarching and indisputable fact that a brief document issued a half century ago has revolutionized that relationship to the point where an observer transported from 1964 would be astonished, even disoriented. After recovering, the Jewish observer might feel the spontaneous urge to say Shechayanu. I don't need to point out that this utopian reaction would be not even the extreme. Nevertheless, the possibility of even a fleeting temptation to say this points to a welcome change that provides opportunities that we need to embrace, though with the same care and ambivalence with which Yaakov presumably returned Esau's embrace in their fraught encounter so many generations ago.